Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to an episode of The Uncommon Journey Podcast with Alyssa Miller, Chloe Mazdaghi, and Philip Wiley. The trio focuses on the unique journeys that people take to break into cybersecurity and the value of diversity for this industry. Many personalities share their stories and encourage those interested in starting a career in InfoSec to embrace their unique backgrounds, even when not technology-related. Enjoy the journey. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Well, hello, and welcome to the Uncommon Journey Podcast. It's great to have you with us for our journey today. I'm Alyssa Miller, and I am here with the most amazing co-host any person could hope to have. I've got Philip Wiley.
Hello, how's it going?
And Chloe Mazdaghi.
Shalom.
So awesome, I love it. We're here with another episode and another trip back to the InfoSec bar. And as the barrel wrestler, the pre-med student, the humanitarian walk in, Hoodoo's sitting there, and she's sipping on ice wine. It's Kim Crawley. Hey, Kim, how are you?
Hi, Alyssa. It's great to finally be on the show. I'm really excited to be here.
We're super excited to have you. Yeah, this has been a long time in coming, but we finally made it happen, which is awesome. So I don't know, you know, there might be one or two listeners who haven't heard of you. I mean, not everybody is like listening and paying attention, but, you know, so for those who maybe don't know you, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I've been contributing blog content for several large tech companies through the past few years. Well, the past several years now, time flies. I think Tripwire State of Security and Joe Petit gave me my big break back in 2016. I was doing that sort of work before that, but he gave me my big break. And then that led to gigs with Sophos Naked Security and Venafi's blog. And I did a little bit of stuff for Komodo for a bit. And I was contributing to Alien Vault's blog, Alien Vault, the SIEM provider. And then AT&T bought them and they rebranded as AT&T Cybersecurity. And I've been contributing to their blog continuously like for the past 4+ years. And I also contributed to BlackBerry Silence's blog back when it was just Silence. And now there isn't really much on the Threat Vector blog anymore. So AT&T is really my only corporate tech blog right now, which is fine because my career is in a transitional period, which was absolutely necessary because these big tech companies in the wake of COVID have slashed their marketing budgets.
Nice. So yeah, I know you do a lot of authoring. I think all three of us here at some point have been actually subjects of some authoring or you've worked with at least all of us on different things. How did you get into that? I mean, how did we end up not only as an author, but then now you're authoring, you know, specifically you do a lot of work in the security space, as you were mentioning. Kind of tell us a little bit about that journey and how that happened.
Okay, well, I was interested in computers ever since I was a little girl. I remember helping my dad troubleshooting his Windows 3.1 OEM back in the day with like printer issues and stuff like that. I had a grade 4 teacher, grade 4 is Canadian for fourth grade, who discouraged my interest in computers, and I'll always resent her for that. But then, with encouragement from others, I picked it up again in my 20s, and I got some basic CompTIA certs, and I had my first remote like tech support position. This was like around 2007, something like that. And I would close on average about 30 tickets a day, and roughly 60-70% of them were malware related. So I spent a lot of time removing all kinds of malware from people's Windows machines, and then often having to fix the damage afterward. I learned how to write Windows registry keys on the spot, for instance. And I saw the earlier ransomware that existed prior to Bitcoin, that would demand a credit card number as a ransom. And I did some political journalism project on the side, vaguely related to the Toronto Star, and someone I met through that gave me the opportunity to work with the InfoSec Institute, which I don't have very positive things to say about that institution. But several years into it, I was noticed by Joe Petit at Tripwire State of Security, and he gave me my big break. And by late 2016, early 2017, I started to make enough money from writing about cybersecurity that it could be my day job, basically. And sometimes I like to try things out myself, because I think just reading reports and writing about them isn't always the best way to learn about things. So sometimes I look at Shodan, sometimes I try to penetration test a virtual machine. I taught myself how to do threat intel, which is actually not that different from writing blog posts sometimes, because you're still researching and you're still writing stuff. But it took me years to get to a place where I could do this as a day job. But I had like a really long journey with a lot of failures and a lot more successes. I had a lot of great luck over the years. And I think this is my destiny, really, is to do this kind of work. And now I'm transitioning more into writing books and doing threat intel. And Phil Wiley, hi, gave me a great opportunity in April to co-write the Pentester Blueprint with him. And it gave me more confidence to write books. So there are definitely books solo written by me on the horizon. In fact, I signed a book deal yesterday. So because the ink is dry on that paper, I will now talk about that more openly. And I'm definitely open to collaborating with Phil again. That was the first time I really collaborated with someone like that. And working with Phil, and I'm not just saying this because he's here, but working with Phil was absolutely wonderful. Like, it was totally conflict-free. Like, it was unrealistically conflict-free. Like, we didn't have a single disagreement throughout the whole process. We just worked in, like, beautiful harmony. So,
okay. Yeah,
congratulations on the new book. Dang it, come on. Go, Phil. It's all yours.
Kim really did a great job on the book, because I was trying to finish the book. I was having a hard time coming up with enough pages. And, you know, I'd communicated with her over the years about, you know, writing advice and that sort of thing. And I thought, you know, I should get a co-author. And fortunately, she helped out. It was really good that not only is she a talented writer, but having that security background was great as well. So, I mean, she brought a lot of good ideas to the book. I mean, it was her idea to interview different people, to use different types of scenarios of jobs that are transferable to those skills. So she had a lot of really great ideas, and it made the book a lot better. So one of the things I learned is, you know, ask for help. It's worthwhile. So it's really, really great to work with her. She's very talented.
I'm a huge book lover myself, and I know people that like to write, they also are obsessed with books. What are some of the books that really push you and motivate you and make you passionate about writing?
As far as stuff that is similar to what I do, one of my favorite books of all time is Stephen Levy's Hackers. I think, you know, no one got hacker culture and how vital it was to Silicon Valley better than he did. And that book has been republished so many times. It's such a classic. And then there's this other book. It's about the history of open source software. I'm gonna mess up the name of it, but it's called like Boutique and the Bazaar or something like that. But you probably know what book I'm talking about, even though I don't have the title correct. And it's great to see, you know, a lot of my friends write really cool books too. And there are a lot of books that have absolutely nothing to do with what I do for a living that I think are really good too. This will really surprise people when I tell you this, but when I read books that have anything to do with computer technology, I read them at my desk, because when I'm at my desk, I'm in work mode. And thinking about computers or cybersecurity or whatever makes me feel like I'm in work mode. When I am in bed reading, which I will usually do like most nights, I love reading books about rock musicians and pop stars. I love reading like rock and pop autobiographies and biographies and memoirs. Literally 60, 70% of the ebooks on my phone fall into that category. But I think if I worked at Rolling Stone magazine, I think it would be reversed. I would be reading books about cybersecurity stuff to relax at night, and reading a book about Mick Jagger or whatever would be work mode.
So you've been around a lot in cybersecurity and a few different roles that you've told us about. And I know you're really active on Twitter too, but you've got a partner in crime on Twitter, this Ossington Bear.
Yeah.
Tell us more about him.
The closer I get to 40, the more and more confident I am about being public about my eccentricities. You know how when you're like a teenager and when you're in your 20s, you're so insecure and you don't want people to judge you on your cheesy taste in music and stuff like that. But as you get older, you get more confident with being eccentric or not being cool or whatever. So Ossington is a very smart teddy bear. And he was getting more confident with using social media. And we decided to do a little video series called Internet Privacy for Noobs. The target audience is non-technical people. The videos are kid-friendly. There's nothing in the video that is inappropriate to show a six-year-old. But my main target audience is adults. But part of the idea was, if people see a talking teddy bear, they're not as intimidated anymore. Hopefully not. Like, people are scared of clowns, but they're not scared of teddy bears, hopefully.
So you do a pretty good job with your ventriloquism, or is that actually Ossington talking?
Wow. Well, Ossington is really talking, definitely. Okay. And I hopefully he won't be too insulted by what you just said, Phil.
I'm a big fan of Ossington. I was just curious.
I have no problems with my eccentricities now. It's like, F it, you know, life's too short to pretend to be someone you're not.
I think it's cool, and you're showing people that it's okay to be themselves too. People are too uptight and try to hide things. I mean, what's wrong with being yourself, you know? That's a good example.
Well, and especially, you were just talking about hacker culture before. I mean, where does hacker culture come from? You know, we are all, I think back to where we were in the 80s with this, we were all kind of the misfits and whatever. You know, we had this weird obsession with technology that wasn't shared by everybody, and it was a little weird. And I mean, you think about that now. I mean, we're in this world where technology is just an inherent part of everything in our lives, and that seems so odd, but it wasn't always that way. And a lot of us, that was very, very out there, very different thinking to be as deep into technology as we are. So I think that message probably resonates with a lot of people. Is that kind of what you're seeing?
Yeah, I don't think new technologies or new ways to use technologies, which is what being a hacker is all about, I don't think that kind of thinking comes from people who have the soul of an accountant. You know what I mean? One of my exes from long ago was like that. I told him, like, you have the soul of an accountant. And when we broke up, I started to date musicians exclusively, because it killed my soul so much to be with someone who was obsessed with, that's not normal. I wish you were normal. Blah, blah, blah.
That sounds boring.
But I've been with Jason Smith for nearly 3 years now, and he's a very eccentric rock musician. I have one of his posters on the wall, and we're very happy together, and he has a lot of hair, and I like his hair very much, so.
So I feel like I gotta stand up for accountants a little bit, just a little, because my father's an accountant, and to be fair, he's the whole reason that I'm into technology the way I am, because, you know, he used to bring home his computer from work when I was four and let me play on it, and that kind of was my start. So I'm just gonna throw that out there, that not being an accountant isn't necessarily bad. Okay. Being a boring person who's hyper-focused on the normal and only the normal, that's really bad.
Okay, so your accountant father didn't have the soul of an accountant. Accounting work was just something that he did as a profession. So fair. Yeah, there's a difference there, yeah.
I still think our accountant listeners are getting insulted, but I'm not sure that we actually have any. So, you know, hopefully not. If so, send me your complaints. I will handle them.
We'll change that. The soul of a hedge fund manager.
Okay, so Cam, you keep mentioning like rock stars and pop stars. Who are some of the ones that when you're reading about them, you want to write about them? If you had an opportunity, if you could write for the Rolling Stone, who would be the artist that you would like to do a wonderful piece on?
I know that I'm like this goth chick with black lipstick and lots of facial piercings and stuff. And I do really love, you know, post-punk and dark wave and stuff like that. But I really, really love jazz fusion as well. And I love, you know, how like jazz and R&B blended in the 70s and the early 80s and whatnot. And one of my favorite musicians of all time is Al Jarreau. And Al Jarreau is notable because he was the only person who ever won Grammys in like the R&B category and the jazz category and whatever other category he won a Grammy in. And he died in 2016, and I was absolutely heartbroken. And he didn't become famous with his music career until he was well into his 40s. So that's unusual. But when I see interviews and performances with him, I just think, wow, he just seemed like such a sensitive, down-to-earth character. So I'm a huge fan of Al Jarreau.
So during all this, you know, busy time writing a book and all your other projects, you managed to host a conference virtually. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, DisinfoSec. I was part, like when COVID started to get serious in March, our friend Leslie Carhart, who's absolutely awesome, she started her own online event, Pancakes Con. And I was so enthusiastic about watching it. And then I found that I tried to get a ticket too late to attend. And I was so disappointed because there were so many good talks. And I saw other people doing online events too. And some crazy idea sparked in my head, like, you could do this yourself. And I had never done video conferencing or anything like that before. I don't know where that idea came from, but I thought, if I'm going to do this, I have to differentiate it from other people's events. So I'm disabled. I mean, I tweet about that a lot now. I'm autistic and I have ADHD. And I thought there are a lot of very gifted people in our industry who are also disabled. And so we'll make that the theme of the event. So DisinfoSec, I hosted it in July, and you can still see the videos up on my YouTube channel. It's obvious that I didn't know what the FR is doing when it came to video editing software or video conferencing. But we had some really great talks, including like Tanya Janka. Tanya Janka always has an awesome talk in her back pocket. I never knew how she was able to do that. I'm terrible at public speaking. And then we had like Michael Middleman and Andrea Downing talk about medical healthcare and stuff like that. And there's been, I think the interest has actually grown since after the event finished. So there's definitely going to be a disinfo set next year, and it should be better because I know a little more about how to do it now without all these technical glitches and stuff. So you make mistakes, but you know, as long as you learn from them, that's the important thing.
But that's what makes it awesome, right? And this is actually, you mentioned two things here that I really love about our industry. One is just that kind of community driven, you know, I mean, it didn't have to be perfect. It didn't, and what is perfect anyway, right? But, you know, it wasn't focused on, hey, oh my gosh, you know, it's got to look all prim and proper and polished. Like, you know, this wasn't RSA. This is like the anti-RSA, right? It was very community, and I love that. Mm-hmm. The other thing is what you said inspired it, and that's Pancake Con, right? Like yeah. Pancakes Con, I think they started, that came up on Twitter on Monday as just like some goofy idea, and by the weekend they had put it together and they actually made a conference out of it. And I think in COVID, that's kind of been a hallmark of our industry, is our ability to adapt and to really make things happen in a collaborative way. I'm kind of curious, when you look at security as a whole, what's the thing that stands out to you that really just, this is what our community is all about?
Yeah, I mean, as you said, for the most part, we're like a really warm, friendly community. And like, I was amazed by how quickly Leslie did that. I mean, because it took me a lot longer to figure out how to do disinfosec, but then again, she probably has a lot more knowledge and experience in that area than I do. But yeah, I mean, it's just amazing, right? I mean, I think it was DEF CON started in the mid 90s as just a bunch of security professionals meeting in Vegas. So, but definitely online events are great for disabled people, especially because a lot of disabled people find it difficult to travel.
How do you think we can improve that more? I know by having virtual events, making when COVID is over with and all that, having some sort of hybrid would definitely help with inclusion on that front. But what other ideas do you have that us as a community can start doing?
Yeah, it was very important to me that DisinfoSec was accessible by both blind people and deaf and hard of hearing people. So it took me a while to figure out how to do that. And I consulted deaf people and blind people, but I figured out how to do live captions in the video feed, but I was only able to do the live captions with Twitch. I spent like a whole like weekend trying to figure out how to do the live captions. And then as far as accommodating blind people are concerned, it's a matter of making sure that if you have a chart or a PowerPoint presentation or whatever, that you describe in your speech what it is. So like descriptive audio. So I advised all the speakers, if you have any visual content, to talk about the visual content, just in case a blind person's.
So looking back on it now with the conference and some of it, I mean, what do you feel like there's something you wish you had done different? Like something that maybe you didn't touch on, that if you do have a next iteration next year, what's that going to look like? What do you think you need to do different, or you want to do different, or you want to try that maybe you didn't have the time or the courage maybe even to try this time around?
Well, this is not an answer that you would have expected, but I was having, like between each of the talks, I was in here and all the video conferencing software was running through here. So people heard that I had a smoke detector issue and it was like beeping every so often. And it didn't get fixed until I was able to have a contractor come in and fix that. And that was so embarrassing. And people were saying all the time, hey, your smoke detector needs a battery change and whatnot. So, I mean, DisinfoSec 2 will be more professional just for not having that. I had a long CFP process for that because no one had heard of it and I wanted the chance to get some good talks. And every single talk proposal I got, I said yes to. So more people know about it now. I hope I don't have to say no to any CFPs. I try to say yes to as many as possible. No offense to the other presenters, but Tanya Janko was definitely the star last year. And yeah, and I might as well say now, because you're asking me about DisinfoSec a lot. I don't know how many people figured it out by looking at the logo, but it's a play on words. It's not just disability InfoSec, it's disinfect, like as in like
COVID. You should have, you should, your badge, you should create a badge next year and it looks like a smoke detector. That should be your badge.
Maybe, yeah. I survived year one with the smoke detector problem.
who were some of the people that inspired you to start writing, especially like going into InfoSec and writing about InfoSec? Who are those people that really led you there? I know Joe did as one of them, but what else?
Kate Brew has always been absolutely wonderful to work with. And I know that as long as she's working for AT&T, they will publish my content. And we have like an absolutely wonderful working relationship. Like anything that I write, as long as it has something to do with cybersecurity and it doesn't obviously contradict AT&T's corporate interests, they will publish for me. So I have a great relationship with her. And yeah, a lot of editors over the years have helped me grow, like David Turner, who works a lot with Joe Petit. And we had a great editor that, you know, Phil and I worked with at Wiley. You know, Gary Schwartz and I, like, we had like a lot of fun conversations. But I think at the very beginning, like long before I got into any of this, it was my dad. My dad didn't write about cybersecurity. He didn't even write nonfiction. He wrote fiction. But I would see him. He was always working on a manuscript when I was a little girl. And he started to talk to me like from the age of four about how to write for a commercial market. So I don't think from childhood I set out to be a professional writer. I think I stumbled into doing it because I didn't know how to do much else. And I think my dad definitely, he didn't help me with any professional connections or anything like that, but he taught me a lot of what I know style-wise and whatnot. But my dad also had some attitudes toward the writing process that now at age 36, I disagree with. Like for instance, he was obsessed with the idea that there was no artistry in what he did. He insisted that he was a craftsman. He liked to call himself a wordsmith more than a novelist or writer or anything else. I do think there's artistry in creative writing, even though, you know, writing about something technical, you have to be very careful with your fact checking. But I'm making a piece of art with the factual information. The art is in how do you explain the facts. So just because something is art doesn't mean it's completely divorced from reality. And then like my dad had other things that he was adamant about too. Like he was like a stiff upper lip Englishman. So just like imagine that, right? He had this thing where I wasn't allowed to have writer's block. You, Kim, you are not allowed to have writer's block. So on one hand, it was great for my discipline because I will open my word processor and I'll just start putting words into it, you know, even if I'm not really confident about those words because daddy didn't let me have writer's block. But yeah, maybe he couldn't have been like so like disciplinary about that stuff.
I kind of feel you on that. My father, he would write a lot. It would be like every night he'd be writing on his computer and whatnot, but it was very disciplined. And he was also seeing it as kind of a wordsmith, but also like that, but he had the idea that's also art. The way that you explain things, even if it's technical, it's a form of art itself. So when you're explaining this, I'm like, hey, I didn't know that about your dad. We have some similarities here with our fathers. My dad was definitely like straight up, like, oh man, every day coming home and I would have to have a red pen next to me and he would just go over everything and be like, you rewrite everything all over again. Yeah.
We should go to the therapy together.
I think we should. Or when COVID's over with, you and I, we'll go get some ice wines. We'll sit out there and we'll talk about our fathers and their artwork.
Yeah. So I think this is another thing I'm a lot more open about now than I used to be. I seriously take astrology seriously. And I think I was destined to do what I do. I think every single human being on earth is equally important, but I also think each of us have a destiny. And whatever work we have to do and whatever struggles we face, our work is still a part of our destiny. So I think I'm destined to do this because honestly, I'm not good at much else other than what I do for a living. Like, I tried to do fast food jobs when I was like 16, 17, and I wouldn't last in any of those jobs for more than a week. I was just so horrible at it.
So let me ask you to that end then. We've talked a little bit. You've mentioned, hey, writing a book or many books in your own name are out there for you. Continuing on with this InfoSec, I guess the question is, what else? I mean, what else do you see on the horizon for you from a professional perspective? What's next for Kim 3 or 5 years from now?
I try not to plan that kind of stuff well in advance because I remember having like lots of big dreams when I was a kid and all of those dreams being crushed. When I was in my mid-20s, I thought I was going to be poor and considered to be a loser my whole life. So I would love to like sit down with 24-year-old me and comfort her and say, no, you will be successful one day. You will work your way out of poverty and all that. And I did, but I think there was a lot of luck there too. I don't like to think about where my career is going to be when I'm like 45, 50 and whatnot, because it's always surprised me. But honestly, there's a part of me that hopes, like I'm 36 now, and there's a part of me that hopes that 30 years down the road, I'm still generally doing the same kind of work because I don't like being in charge of other people. Honestly, I don't. I only like being in charge of myself. And I think I've found my niche. So I'm sure there'll be some unexpected changes over the course of my career. Like this year, doing a lot less corporate blogging and a lot more book and threat and soul stuff. But I don't really like change that much, to be honest with you. All the big changes in my life, I felt like my environment was imposing the change on me and I had to adapt.
You know, it's actually refreshing to hear you say that. I mean, I think for a lot of us, you know, I've talked to other people who've had kind of similar experience. You know, a lot of my career has been just sort of one serendipitous occurrence after the next, right? I tell people, you know, we allude to it at the beginning of the show, right? I was a pre-med major. I never planned anything. And so now here I sit middle-aged, I am north of 40. And it's like, I think about like, boy, I never really had a plan. I don't have a plan now. What am I doing? I've been, you know, it drives a lot of imposter syndrome and other things, but I think you've touched on something that's really important, that you really don't have to have a plan. And it is okay to just let things sort of happen as they come. You know, I know a lot of people got into security that way. They say they just sort of fell into it. I'm in that camp too.
I just.
So I appreciate that point because I think it's important for our listeners to know too. There's a lot of people trying to get into cybersecurity these days who are stressing, how do I plan this out? How do I build a career path for me? And the reality is a lot of times, as scary as it is, you just got to sort of let it happen to you as much as you try to make it happen. I'm not suggesting sit by the sidelines. You know, I mean, you do have to get out there and explore and learn and do things, but a lot of it will just sort of, it does sort of just come if you let it. So as hard as it is for me to say that, that I think that's the reality.
I think what applies to all four of us here is isn't it great when you get jobs just based on your reputation? Because that's been my life for the past handful of years, and I think that's all of us.
Yeah.
Like it is soul killing to pound the pavement and send out so many resumes and never hear anything back. So when your career is in a place where the jobs come to you, it's so much better for your mental health. We don't have to fight for work anymore.
Which it's wild to say that, right? I mean, especially in a time when people are, you know, have been struggling for a number of months now. I think, you know, especially in security, hiring's really picked up in the last few months. But yeah, you do get to that point where you've done enough, you've seen enough, and especially, you know, when we do have this perception of a cyber skills gap, whether that's reality or not is debatable. And you know me, I'll debate it all day. But, you know, I think there does come that time where these companies that are having a harder time searching for people, it becomes a little more competitive and they will reach out. So yeah, you kind of just sort of let it, you know, work hard, do the things you need to do, grab those cool opportunities when you see them. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid that they're not part of your plan and move forward.
Are you really happy, Alyssa, that you didn't like go into medicine?
I'm thrilled I didn't go into medicine. I mean, especially right now, come on. I look at these poor, our healthcare system and the abuse they're taking right now in this pandemic. I mean, now more than ever, I can't imagine the horrors that those poor people have to see every day and all what they have to put up with. I mean, I adore the fact that they exist. I'm so glad they're there because yeah, people like me who aren't capable of doing that. I mean, I couldn't be more thankful. So yeah. So yeah, I'm glad I stumbled my way into tech and into InfoSec.
I feel the same way about parenthood. I'm certain now that I'm never going to be a mom, but I have so much respect for people who are good parents. And it's kind of weird. I'm getting into my late 30s now, and even being a millennial, more than half of people my age are parents with school-aged children. And I have so much respect for the ones who can be a good parent, but I can't do it. I was in the supermarket a few days ago and I was in the checkout and paying for my groceries. And at the other till was a woman who was my age, or maybe she was younger than me, and she had a crying baby, and the baby just kept on crying and kept on crying. And I thought, children are delightful once they're 6 years old or older, but there's no way that I could stand a crying baby. And I have no idea. And if you can't handle parenthood, you shouldn't become a parent. So the crying baby thing just reminded me, you know, don't become a mom.
I love what you're sharing and everything, because I know when, like, growing up, there's always that talk, like, if you are a woman, then you have to have a kid. And if you don't have a kid, then you're not a woman. And I'm like, excuse me? Like, it's, you know, it's choice. And sometimes it's just circumstances.
But I mean, Dolly Parton, I think, is 70 now, and she never had any kids.
Yeah. See? So. Honestly. All right. I'm going to start doing the 10 questions. Are you ready, Kim?
I'm ready.
I always say roll up your sleeves, but I see you have an energy drink in your hand. So we're ready to go, and you got a t-shirt on, so no need to roll up sleeves. All right. First question I have for you. What's your favorite movie?
My favorite movie is Girl Interrupted.
What is your spirit animal?
Crow.
I'm not surprised by that, actually. I was thinking it was going to be a crow or a blackbird. Okay. Next question I have for you. What's your favorite book of all time?
Oh, that's a tough one. That's a really, really, really tough one. I have so many interests. I guess if I have to just randomly choose a favorite book, maybe Parker's Astrology.
Okay, next question I have for you. Would you feel more comfortable writing a song or writing a sonnet?
A song, definitely. I've actually written songs that no one has ever heard.
Can I hear them one day?
Maybe if I work
with
up
that
courage.
Ice wine, and father writing issues and hearing music. Excellent. Next question I have for you. If you could have any pet in the world, what would it be?
A Newfoundland dog. I love Newfoundland dogs so much.
Okay. What do you prefer, coffee or tea?
Tea.
Do you prefer cloudy weather or too bright and sunny weather?
Surprising for a goth, I actually prefer sunny weather, but I wear like SPF 50 and sunglasses. Well, I need to get like tinted lenses, but yeah, definitely sunny weather.
Okay. What is the one essential thing you always put in your bag or your purse that most people would never know?
Oh, that's a good question. I have, maybe this isn't such a crazy answer, but I always have like loose candies somewhere in my bag. Like I'll buy a great big bag of candy and then it will just spill out haphazardly. So there's always like, and it gets wet and it gets sticky and then my cigarettes start leaking and then the tobacco comes out. So
there's
candy tobacco residue and I have to, people would be grossed out by the candy tobacco residue.
Oh my God. Okay. What's your favorite candy?
My favorite candy. Before I became vegan, Sour Patch Keys. Sour Patch Keys. Like the keys were like, those are really
good. Wait, rewind. Good. You're a vegan? I'm a vegan. Oh my God. How did I not know this?
I'm like very quiet about it because
yeah, okay.
I don't want to fit into the stereotype of the
people. Yeah, I don't either. I'm a terrible vegan. I still got leather. I have honey once in a while. Like I'm a terrible vegan. So
rock musician boyfriend wears a leather jacket 10 months of the year because it's part of his image. And he is vegetarian. And he just tries not to think about it too much.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. How long have you been a vegan for?
Only 3 years now.
What's your favorite?
Since I started dating Jason.
Okay. And my last question for you is, what's your favorite dish that you make?
Oh, this is a good one because I actually do like cooking. I love buying Japanese curry, which comes in like little packages. And I love mixing that with tofu cubes and white rice, but mild Japanese curry. So Japanese curry is mild to begin with, but mild, you're basically, it's like apple cinnamon level spiciness.
Love it. I think that was more than 10 questions, but thank you.
I mean, it always is. I don't think we've gotten through other than maybe the first episode where it was only 10, but... We still call it the 10 question lightning round because it's got a nice ring to it.
Yeah.
Well, Kim, this unfortunately is all the time we have, but it's been super fun talking with you. Definitely big shout out. We'll take it one more time to remind people, check out the Pentester Blueprint. Phil and Kim have done an amazing job. If you haven't seen the book yet, you haven't checked it out, get out there, get it electronically. I think it's electronic as well.
Yeah, right? Oh yeah, both paperback and ebook. So anywhere, either or both are sold.
Get out there, check it out. It is definitely worth a read, even if you're not looking to become a pen tester necessarily. It'll give you some interesting context. But yeah, that's unfortunately all the time we've got for this week's journey. But thank you again, Kim, for being here. On behalf of Chloe, Phil, and myself, always great. It's always fun. We really love it. We'll see you on down the road, folks. Take care. Until next time on The Uncommon Journey.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of The Uncommon Journey podcast. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.